Welcome to Cinema Chop Shop. Watch, chop, retrofit.
Speaking of Charleston, they're building a pedestrian bridge across the Ashley River, which is pretty damn cool.
But this is not a municipal planning podcast. This is Cinema Chop Shop. It's a movie podcast. And we're glad you're joining with us tonight because we're going to be talking about movies. I'm your host, Sean, and I'm joined by Travisito.
Hello, hello.
And Todd.
Howdy.
And Joey is MIA.
Yeah, we think he's okay. He's probably just like being a dad.
Probably. That's probably what it is. I had an idea a few weeks ago. There's a genre of movies that we did an episode on
very early.
Season 1, episode 20.
Was there a date on that?
I'm
very curious to know.
I don't.
Shoppers, go back. Email us.
But we're talking about samurai movies today, and it has not been discussed since then. We decided to revisit the genre and talk about some more because they're great, and there's a lot of them.
Why now?
I was looking for a topic that I thought would be fun.
Does the wild success of the miniseries Shogun have anything to do with the inspiration?
It does not. I've not seen it, and I actually kind of thought about watching that, but I kind of ran out of time. So
gotcha.
That is also based on a manga series, as is two of our features at least.
It's manga.
Manga, whatever. Manga.
Wait, do you say mango or mongo?
The format, we're going to talk about a feature film that we've all watched in the first half. Mm-hmm. And in the second half, we're going to discuss some other samurai films that we have watched, liked, we want to talk about. And of course, we took off the table immediately Seven Samurai and Rashomon, since we've talked about both of those at length.
And the, what was it, Sword of Doom?
I think it was Sword of Doom, yes. Yeah. So today's episode, we're going to be discussing the 1973 film Lady Snowblood.
So Lady Snowblood sounds like a character from Game of Thrones.
Totally. Winter is coming, and yeah. So is revenge.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And that's actually on the show. That's what they call it when a noble woman gets their period.
She becomes Lady Snowblood for 1 week.
Yeah, she was visited by Lady Snowblood.
So this movie was hugely inspirational for Quentin Tarantino with Kill Bill.
Absolutely.
In his usual retconning style, he said, well, yeah, it was a tribute. I did it as an homage. I did it on purpose. But you say that at the time.
Yeah.
You know?
We'll get into that some more later, too, in terms of giving credit where credit's due.
Indeed.
That's kind of what made me key in on this one. I was doing some research into some of the best samurai movies of all time. And this one ranks pretty highly on a lot of lists, but also that kind of current, semi-current cultural reference to the Kill Bill, which is a movie that most people will have seen. It was fun to go back and watch this and kind of see some of those inspiration points.
Oh, right down to the music, the choreography, the gratuitous
fountains of blood.
Exactly.
And that is a genre convention, as I'll discuss when I later on.
Definitely, as you get into the color film era of samurai movies. Mm-hmm. And I made a reference in one of my Letterboxd check-ins. The one you're going to talk about reminded me of a lot of the films I saw as a child. USA Network used to have Kung Fu Theater on Saturdays in the afternoons, and they would show a bunch of dubbed Asian films, sometimes karate, kung fu, and sometimes samurai. And
USA Network existed in the 60s.
Yeah, man.
And you'd have to assume that the manga influence played a factor in that. Just sort of the...
Sure.
The, you know...
Blood for artist's sake. You know,
Speaking of the blood, though, it looked really fake.
Oh, yeah. It's that 1970s tomato blood.
It looks like paint.
Well, go back and look at any of the Hammer horror films, and you'll see that same quality. It's that red tomato-y color.
And that's
paint.
Usually not how the human body works. When you get stabbed, a geyser comes out. No matter where you get stabbed on your body.
It depends on how much sodium is in your diet and your blood pressure. Yeah.
Lady Snowblood, 1973, directed by, and again, disclaimer, we apologize for any gross mispronunciations of some of these names. Directed by Toshiya Fujita and it stars Mako Kaji.
That was a valiant effort.
Mako Kaji was based on the manga of the same name, Lady Snowblood. By the way, I don't know if you guys noticed this, but the star, Mako Kaji, also sang the song the movie. She is a pop music star of era.
Very beautiful also, we just have to say. It's like in the description of the film, she's very,
very
beautiful.
Very beautiful.
Well, can we talk about her for a minute? Because she is, since you brought up that aspect, I mean, she's a legend in Japanese film, and in particularly these genre films. So she was in a number of different series. So of course there are two Lady Snowblood movies, but before that she was in two other lengthy series. One was called Stray Cat Rock, I think.
And each of the episodes, but they're like an hour and a half each.
Well, and there were four of those films made in like 2 years, from 70 to 71. And then I haven't seen any of those, but I've seen all of the movies in the Female Prisoner 701 Scorpion series. There are four films in that, also filmed over a 2 year period between 72 and 73, right before Lady Snowblood. And so she is really steeped in the genre of that particular period. There was really a 5 year period where she was in tons of, action, kung fu / samurai type films. The female prison, the Female Prisoner series was, like a revenge, rape revenge type of,
a lot like the, like some of those blaxploitation films.
The women in prison, blaxploitation films. Yep. They kind of dovetail in terms of time frame as well. I think that's interesting that the Japanese culture picked up on that as well.
Yep.
So Stray Cat Rock is also the name of my blues fusion album.
All right, so a little bit of a synopsis on this movie. The film is about a girl named Yuki who is seeking revenge on three people, but it's really four people,
right?
Who raped her mother and killed her father and her brother.
Yes.
She was born in a prison. Her mother had what landed her mom in the prison? She murdered one. Okay, yeah. That's what it was. And so she landed herself in prison and became a whore.
She killed prison guards. Yeah.
She produced an heir and a vengeful.
That's right.
Vessel.
And the way that she was able to kill the one member of this gang that she was able to kill was in the middle of coitus, because she pretended to be into him until the right moment came along, as was said in the narration, and then she stabbed him.
So she tells and confesses to all of her cellmates that she had sex with all of these prison guards in an attempt to become pregnant. Yes. And she basically gives birth in prison and dies in childbirth, but not before she reveals to her cellmates what the plot is and what their responsibility is.
They have to
get this daughter out of this prison and get her to become a revenge machine and basically bring justice to the remaining motherfuckers.
So this origin story was heavily drawn from by Tarantino with his Oren Ishii origin story. The animated sequence is one of my favorite parts of that movie, and it's drawn directly from this.
Yep. And one thing that's always... So Quentin Tarantino calls these types of movies a revenge-o-matic, but these movies very often have some revenge element involved with them, almost always.
There's a word for this type of movie in Japanese, and I don't remember the exact word, and I'm not going to try to pronounce it, but it means basically period drama.
Yes.
So it was a whole thing, a genre of film. Stylistically, just fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
I really loved the idea that she was born out of this this act of violence and then became a tool of violence.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we also just have to talk about the idea that revenge is complicated. It gets real sticky.
Yeah, it does. So we're introduced to her very early on with she's a very almost demure Japanese lady. Mm-hmm. She's got her little umbrella. And she comes across one of her targets and the fucking umbrella's got a sword in it.
Of course it does.
And it's so badass.
Yeah. I have to say that my lovely wife, Michelle, for a long time had a sword cane, a legit sword cane. I think that TSA took it away.
Makes sense. Makes sense. She underwent some very rigorous training from a brutal master.
Oh yeah,
that those scenes were pretty cool.
Yeah, he throws her down a barrel.
He puts her in a barrel and rolls her down a hill.
Right, and one of the assistants has a pity on her, and she's like, "No, she's got to jump out at the right time."
But it's a Rocky training montage.
It is, yeah. Right? It totally is. So we have the context of just how badass she is and what she's gone through. Again, very much in that Kill Bill kind of...
Who was the master that trained Kiddo? I can't remember his name, but the guy with the very long Fu Manchu, gray, whitish hair. That's basically this character.
Sure, yeah. He's a bastard, and I guess he's a sadistic bastard.
Right.
Because he gets off on this. We kind of join in this... in media res, where she's already in this act of pursuing her revenge, we get these flashbacks of all of this backstory.
Yeah, I thought that was one of the editing was very skillful in this. I thought where it went back, because it was not chronologically told.
Right.
You're jumping around in time. And I thought that was really the editing of that was really well done between
yet another influence on Tarantino.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Non-linear story arc.
So she very skillfully, just shrewdly employs a mole, an informant in the underworld. She gets him to...
Who happened to be an actual mole.
Yeah, he was a mole man. To kind of give her some direction on where these people are hiding out. She's milking him for information, and he definitely obliges. And one of her first kills is the drunk.
Yes.
Right. And she executes him without much...
And trouble. That's where it gets a little sticky, because you almost kind of feel sorry for this guy. He's got a daughter, so we know that he's trying to take care of his daughter, and he's obviously in a terrible alcoholic state.
Fuck that. If I felt bad for every drunk motherfucker that I got vengeance on.
You do bring up the fact that he had a daughter, and that comes into play later.
Yes, yes.
And then she goes along with her next kill, which she finds out one of the guys died in a shipwreck. And she's like, well, shit. I mean, it's like this gut punch to her in terms of my mission is compromised in that I don't get to kill this guy. Someone's already done it for me. Mother Nature. She befriends a journalist.
Yes.
Along the way.
He's a journalist / manga or manga artist too, right? Because he's writing...
And a part-time sidekick.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's actually some scenes of him that reminded me of an old film noir thing where he's almost like a gumshoe detective burning the midnight oil, working late at night. And
yep.
I thought that kind of gave me a little chuckle.
Yep.
But her path of revenge takes her to another... And the woman, Okono, she was an accomplice.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, she didn't participate in the rape, but she was just as complicit as the males in the group.
And almost the most sadistic.
She was. She
because
was
she seemed to
bitch.
Be the Charles Manson of the group, kind of pulling the strings, it seemed like.
And then watching it go down.
Exactly.
And she gets her comeuppance in the end, that's for sure. She gets cut in half.
Yeah. And after she hung herself.
And let me ask you, was there any blood involved?
Quite a bit, actually. Funny you should ask. And what I loved about that particular scene is that there's actually a literal curtain that comes down at the end of that kill. I was like, nice. Good job. So it turns out that the guy who died at sea faked his own death.
Yep.
And as luck would have it, his son is the journalist / manga artist who has the hots for our hero. So funny that all comes together at a masquerade ball. Then that's where we start to get, I got a real.
I love that scene.
Well,
actually.
I do too, but I also got a real Kill Bill theme from it, feel from it when the scene where she was fighting up the stairs with people in all the masks and the kid with the
crazy
88.
That was an awesome scene when it seems like she's killed this guy and then he's got this freaky mask on that gets pulled off. Remember this?
I don't remember that, but it sounds awesome.
You mean Kill Bill or
no.
Lady Snowblood?
Yeah, Lady Snowblood. Remember there was the guy that looked like her target in the room?
Oh, the decoy. Yeah.
And then they pulled the mask off. And it was like this gnarly mask where it was, you know, anyway.
I do remember now that you mention it. And it was like, oh, that's where Mission Impossible got their idea.
Right.
So, yeah, the father, Gashiro, what an evil fuck. He shoots his own son.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In this whole melee.
Because he's protecting her from getting shot.
Yeah.
But then,
multiple times, by the way, and it does take on an Austin Powers feel at some point where it's like, I've been badly shot. Please, somebody, you know, hurry up and come and cut his head off. Yeah.
But Yuki, being the cold-blooded bitch that she is, she stabs through him to get to the father.
Right.
And then he takes a tumble over the railing. And then in the final scene of the film, I hate to call her the prostitute, but that's what she... her name is Kobu. She stabs Yuki in her own quest for revenge.
Right. So a lot like the Vivica Fox character and her daughter. in Kill Bill. But there was always rumors, or there's been rumors, that there would be a Kill Bill Volume 3 starring that daughter.
I wish they would make it.
Yeah.
That would be so...
Make that your 10th film.
Well, he's abandoned the movie critic, as they announced
this week. I know, right?
So, yeah.
And Brad Pitt was going to play the same character from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
And the movie critic was going to be played by that guy... what's the fat guy from Cobra Kai who's hilarious? He was going to play whatever that
Chris
actor's
Farley.
Name is. Well, actually, that
same
guy
is actually... Fat guy in a Cobra Kai.
You joke, but that same guy actually has been attached to a Chris Farley biopic. But anyway, whatever that guy's name is, he was supposedly going to play the actual movie critic role.
Okay.
But anyway.
But it's scrapped.
It's scrapped, yeah.
So
he could do your idea.
So that's the plot of the movie.
Yeah.
And we just ran it down start to finish because... we wanted to. And sorry,
beautiful film.
Spoilers. You can watch this thing on HBO Max or Max.
Or
Criterion.
Mm-hmm.
So they
named that first one after both of our dogs.
I know, right? Max? Yep. I quite like this movie. I thought it was a lot of fun. I didn't think it was a masterpiece. It didn't have that...
I thought it was perfectly fine.
It didn't have that Akira Kurosawa feel of being way more important. But then again, it doesn't
I guess it depends on how you define masterpiece.
Well, yeah, I thought it was great, though.
Of exploitation cinema, I think it is a masterpiece of that type of film.
It is it's indicative of its time. I mean, for 1973, that period yielded a lot of those kind of action films. And this thing's chock full of it, and you've got a badass heroine in the lead role. And yeah, like you said, Travis, she was beautiful. And really good in this.
I also think it's interesting that you, or not interesting, but correct, that you mentioned the film noir tones in some of the scenes, because I think there's a lot of overlap there as well between the samurai films and the film noir. I think there was actually even a film noir movement out of Japan.
There's tons.
Well, Kurt Kurosawa, pretty much, if he wasn't doing a period piece samurai film, it was essentially a noir film he was doing.
And the film noir movement lasted in Japan through the 60s. There are all these mod 60s films that ride this line of being both
Tokyo Drifter and things.
They're being like too cool for school, but at the same time,
Fast and Furious Tokyo Drifter.
Oh, my bad.
But you say that, I want to mention, hats off to the art direction. There's some cool shit in this that reminded me of some of the stuff that was later used, like in Sin City, with this high contrast snow painted red. And just some neat visuals.
Well, the color palette, I was like, I wonder if Dario Argento watched some of this stuff. Because if you see Suspiria and things like that, very similar, obviously very different films, but in terms of the artistic cinematography and the aesthetic, kind of similar.
I thought it was cool. I'd never heard of it before this week or 2 weeks ago when we started researching for the episode. Had you guys research. Heard of it? Yeah, research. That's called Googling. Have you heard of this before?
Of the film?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I actually bought I watched the film for the first time a couple years ago, and I actually bought it during one of the recent Criterion sales.
Okay.
I'm actually a pretty big fan of this type. Revenge-O-Matics, as Tarantino calls them. I really like those movies, and so that's kind of up my alley. And so I had heard of it.
Have you seen the sequel?
So that was one of the plans I had this week that I didn't get to. So the film I'm going to talk about later has six films in the series. I was like, I'm going to watch all these. I'm going to watch both the Lady Snowbloods. I got through four of the six in my
series.
Just
like being and a then dad just, happened. And
exactly.
Yes. Again.
I definitely had to rewatch Lady Snowblood.
Yeah. How do we get paid to watch movies? That's the code that I get to crack.
How do these guys manage it?
I think that's what's next in line. All right, that's Lady Snowblood. And as Travis pointed out, it's a perfect Game of Thrones character. So we're going to take a break and go pee in the yard, but not before we say,
let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby and get ourselves some
a katana and some tomato soup.
Some gushers?
I was just going to go for sushi.
Hey, I like that too.
Yum, yum. It's time for a tasty and refreshing snack. We promise to satisfy your hunger, your thirst, your sweet tooth. So visit our refreshment center now. Let's go.
And we're back.
Welcome back.
We all took a big, long... long samurai pee in the yard.
Yeah. You ever hear somebody say welcome in, but it sounds like they're saying it in German? Welcome in.
Yeah, I mean, that's where I go.
So we're back from intermission. What do we like to do, dude?
Beer check-ins.
Can we do the one that I brought?
Yeah, sure.
So this is not Japanese. We found out before the show that it's Chinese, but it is hard kombucha. Hard kombucha. And this is a brand called Strange Beast with an I in the middle of strange. And, oh, like strain.
Like a strain.
I get it. And it's from Sierra Nevada Brewing Company.
Cool.
And this is a watermelon, sea salt, lime, and mint.
Pour it up.
Can you crack it for us? There. Once again, 7%. So my lovely wife, Michelle, picked this up. On a recent visit to her boyfriend, Billy Strings.
Her boyfriend, Billy Strings. That's right. I thought that was a funny joke.
What is it? The worst kept secret in town?
Yes. 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 Your lovely wife, Michelle, has a lover. And his name is Billy Strings.
Yep.
This reminds me of dropping a Jolly Rancher in a Zima.
Oh, man. That used to happen.
That was a perfect description.
So you like it? That's what you're saying?
I feel like I'm in college.
Yes, college.
Sorry, that's when they came out for me.
Yep.
Zima.
Well, you know...
Is there a little bit of grocery store wine in there, too, maybe?
Some Strawberry Hill, some Boone's Farm.
Boone's Farm, baby. Hell yeah.
You steal it from the grocery store and drink it under a bridge.
So I'm assuming you're paying a premium and price for this from Sierra Nevada... To get the experience of drinking a $2.
I love that you're trashing this beer because
I'm not trashing it.
I stole it from Michelle and she got it at the Sierra Nevada Brewery.
I'm not trashing it. I'm just thinking that there's probably a cheaper way to get this experience.
Of course, she's an avid listener.
Yeah, I believe that. Oh boy. Wow. All right, so we're back into the second half of the Samurai episode, and the task at hand is we're all going to do our little book reports about some Samurai films that we've watched in preparation for the show that we want to share with you. And Todd, I'm going to let you go first.
All right, so you mentioned a book report, and that's going to factor into my film here.
As in it's a book-length report?
Oh, well, there is a bound book element, but probably that too. All right, so the name of the film that I'm going to be discussing is Lone Wolf and Cub, Sword of Vengeance. I said sword for a second.
Sword of Vengeance, not to be confused with Sword of Doom. Yep.
Right.
Right. This was the first of what became a six-film series. The Criterion Collection actually released all six of these films in a collection that I bought just a blind buy a couple of years back, and so this was a perfect excuse for me to kind of run through them.
blind.
Yes. Actually, I'll have something to say about blindness as well in a minute.
Oh my God, there's so much nuance.
So there's a little bit of a lot of overlap with some of this genre stuff here. So the first thing that's interesting about this is, so Lady Snowblood was based on a manga, as we mentioned. The name of the author of that was this guy, and I'm going to butcher his name, Kazuya Koki.
Sounds good to me.
He also wrote the manga that Lone Wolf and Cub was based on. And in addition to that, he wrote the screenplay for the first film in the series. If you watch the films kind of back to back or around the same period of time, you will see aesthetically kind of similarities, thematic similarities, the revenge angle. So that was one thing that I thought was pretty cool, which I didn't. I mean, it was just happened to kind of random that happened. But these films came out around the same time. Lone Wolf and Cub, the first film, came out about 72. It's interesting that all of these were pumped. Once they decided that the film was popular, they would pump these things out quick.
Yeah.
So the Lone Wolf and Cub movies, there are six of them. They came out over a three-year period between 72 and 75. This was the first one of his to be adapted. But this guy, Kazuya, is a very prolific manga author. A film that we're not going to talk about, the producer of the movie is a guy named Shotaro Katsu. There's a 25-film series called Zatouchi, The Blind Swordsman. So
25 film?
There are 25, and Criterion released these in a box set. 25 of these Blind Swordsman films that predate the other one. So between 1962 and 73, all those films came out.
And you bought this box set?
It was a beautiful box set, and yes, I did. Dawn of the Blind.
They were like,
the best one is when he goes to the fire festival.
Yep, exactly.
Todd, we got your money. Don't you worry. Hey,
when they do the 50% sales, I'm buying something. Sorry. And it's usually a blind buy. But anyway, the guy that was the star of those Zatouchi films was initially, they wanted him to star in it, but he, you know, was acting in those films still, and so he decided he wanted to produce them. The character's name, Ito Ogami, the main character, is a guy named Tamashiburo Wakayama, who is the brother of Katsu. Now, why they don't have the same name, I don't know. I didn't, you know, get into all that.
Is it one of the situations where your first name is your last name and your last name is your first name?
I have no idea. The information I read said they were brothers. It didn't say stepbrothers. Or half brothers or anything like that. Stepbrothers. So I don't know. But anyway. But he was Wakayama, up until this point, he'd had bit parts in a bunch of movies, Yakuza films, that sort of thing. And badly wanted this role. So much so that he showed up to Kazuya's house, the guy that wrote the manga, and
he brought
a samurai sword with him. Mm-mm. And because he's an overweight guy. The guy in the manga is like this fit, you know, guy. So he wanted to prove to him that he could do the flips and all this stuff. And he did them for me. He's like, cool, you got the part.
That's fucking awesome.
Yeah. I mean, it's, when I read that story, I was like, man, that's pretty awesome. But
now, like, hold on. Real quick, did you say he brought him a bear cub?
Yeah, that's what I thought would have been funnier. This reminds me of the time that Sean Young auditioned for Batman Returns in full Catwoman outfit that she brought herself to the audition. Didn't work out so well for her.
Right. The actor they did want to play it was the guy with the cheeks. The Japanese actor that the Tokyo Joker with the cheeks.
Toshiro Mifune?
I can't remember his name, but that's who they originally wanted to play the role, but he was busy or something like that. But anyway, I thought that was a little interesting tidbit. Those are some interesting kind of little overlap things there with the previous movie and other movies in the genre. But
can you isolate a clip of Todd saying, with the cheeks?
Anyone who has seen enough Japanese cinema knows exactly what I'm talking about when I say the guy with the cheeks. The guy that got cheek implants.
Okay.
He looks like a chipmunk. So the plot will actually be a little bit briefer than that other stuff, but it's a cool movie. It's got the revenge element, but it's set in medieval Japan, like mm-hmm. most of these movies tend to be. The main character, Ogami, is a ritual executioner. So there's this weird thing in Japanese culture, and I think your movie, I think, has a title related to that, but Harikiri, where they... You know, there are some executions that are like legitimate. We're killing this person mm-hmm. because they did something wrong. And then other cases where they, you know, it's ritualistic. They command right. they do it for the good of the clan or something along those lines. And so that's his role. And it's a very powerful role in the community. As early in the movie, the Yagyu clan, there are a lot of different clans. It gets a little convoluted, but you know, you can kind of get it as you watch, but
Yagyu be complicated.
Yep. They're called a shadow clan in the movie. But anyway, so in other words, there's the main group, that's supposedly running things. And then there's a shadow group that's kind
of
trying
to, clan who serves
exactly.
Master Shredder.
Correct. There you go. Perfect example. This shadow group comes in, because they want to take over this role of the executioner. And I can't remember, there's a Japanese title for this role. I'm not going to even try to pronounce it, but it's a very powerful role. So they come in, they murder his wife, they plant evidence in his like prayer room that he has, or his meditation room, that would implicate him as being devious towards the primary clan in order to get rid of him. So they order him to commit this ritualistic suicide. He refuses and vows revenge after his wife has been murdered. And he and his son, as he tells us, are going to go on the path of the demon way to hell.
Now, is this the cub and the lone wolf?
So they have a young son. At the beginning of the movie, it's a baby. Fast forward to where we, after all this happens, mm-hmm. he's pushing him in a cart, and he's probably about year and a half, 2 years old. And so he's just kind of going around peddling his services as an assassin. He literally has a sign on his cart saying something to the effect
of assassin for hire.
And he has a flat price. He's very firm about that. If people try to offer him more, he won't take it. It's like 500.
He's the Aldi of assassins.
Yes.
So he's kind of like the progenitor, the early version of the modern bro dad.
Yeah.
Who takes the baby in like a strap-on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yep.
Giant fanny pack.
The sling. Yes.
To the bar.
Yeah.
Kind of. Well, it gets kind of dark as shit, though, because there's this whole thing about going to the demon way to hell where his son, who's an infant and has no, like, doesn't make conscious decisions, he makes his son as a baby, like, whatever object his son crawls to will determine his fate. If he crawls to one thing, he's going to kill him.
Hands-off parenting.
Yeah. And if he crawls to the other thing, he gets to join him on the demon path to hell.
He offers him a toy.
Yeah.
Or the sword, and the child goes to the sword.
Right.
It's like, oh, you badass kid. Yeah.
Now, what if he put nachos instead of a toy?
So the movie starts from there.
Oh, we're still at the start?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to try to speed up here. Because all six movies kind of go with the same formula, which is that he's going after this clan that killed his wife. And
if you could say clan like four more times, we need our numbers to go up in Alabama.
Hey, that's what they call them. They call
YouTube is gonna love this episode.
He's going after this family or this clan that murdered his wife, put him on the demon path to hell. And I won't tell much more about the plot because it's pretty straightforward in all of the films. Similar to Lady Snowblood, he's just seeking out revenge and doing a lot of damage when he does it.
Yeah.
But the fight scenes in this are amazing. The actor Wakanyama really is apparently doing a lot of the act or the sword fighting, and the flipping around and stuff like that. Now, not the flipping around where he's jumping 15 feet in the air, but like, you know, some of the, he can do a little bit of acrobatics and that sort of thing.
That's cool.
There's the,
you said he was 50?
He was 42.
42. Okay. Yep.
There's the gushing blood element that was in Lady Snowblood. Blood just like, if you get stabbed anywhere, on your arm, anywhere, it's coming out like a geyser. And it's a beautiful cinematography palette with the backdrop of the Japanese countryside. It's set kind of in the countryside, which I'm sure they're doing because it's supposed to be in, you know, the medieval period.
It's a little known fact that everybody in medieval Japan had both hypertension and hemophilia.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Right. And the one other thing I'll add before I leave you, sorry, but is the part with the kid who, as the movie progresses, becomes more and more involved in the violence. So there's a scene towards the end of the movie where one of the killers are coming towards him and he presses a button, and in the cart, a sword comes out and stabs the people that are, or the person that's trying to attack him.
Now, sounds really sexual.
Now I'm going to sell you on this movie, Travis, because Todd omitted a very key element.
That is?
Titties.
Titties.
Oh yes.
There is lots of nudity in this episode, in this version of the movie.
If I was to die on a boat, it would be the Titanic.
Yes.
So, there's a weird scene that would not pass the Me Too muster.
They force him to have sex with her, or they force her to have sex with him. There's that element, but then she comes back later in the pool, the bathroom,
and he grabs her and
and
strips her clothes.
Doesn't sound like
off.
Any of this passes the consent test.
No, it does not.
But it looks like he's going to rape her, but then it turns out no, he was doing something for her own good. Where he was going to be tender with her. I mean, it's really weird. It's really weird.
It's strange. Lone Wolf and Cub. I'll even add a little bit more to this.
I think I might have seen this movie.
So Lone Wolf and Cub, the manga was republished in the 1980s, maybe 90s, by Dark Horse Comics. And all of the covers were done by Frank Miller.
Oh,
that's cool.
So, you know, Mr. Sin City and Mr. Screenplay for RoboCop 2. So there is a movie tie-in there.
We should also mention that all of these movies we're talking about, most of them, are based on manga. And the reason for that is that art form predates film by like fourfold or fivefold. I'm really good at math. But
one thing I learned. Yeah,
that's the reason.
Yeah, and in Japan, in particular, during this era, manga was bigger. I mean, bigger than movies. I mean,
adults, tentacle porn.
Like an everyday average adult would have like a manga, you know, book on or you know collection on their coffee table type
that
of
I think. I think the idea is that you had a lot of public transit people, commuters and things, and that was what people would read on the train or whatever. Mm-hmm. So yeah, Lone Wolf and Cub, there you have it.
I went to a silent book club thing last night and I read a comic book on my tablet.
Nice.
It was Batman Damned. Have you heard of this one?
No.
It's pretty good. The narrator is Constantine.
Oh, John Constantine?
I don't know.
The Hellblazer?
Is that worth going to, by the way? I've looked at that and thought, oh, that looks like it might be fun. Is it?
I've only been to one. My lovely wife, Michelle, is a big supporter of it, member, participant.
I mean, was there much interaction? It sounds like you...
No, okay, so here's how it works. You have to, join the list on Facebook or whatever, and then... The first hour is people just talking and interacting and talking about what they've been reading. And then the second hour is reading by yourself.
Oh. Well,
yes. Or reading in your head. Reading to the demons in your head.
Also known as nap time.
Well, I read a comic book.
Okay.
So
that's fine. All right, Travis, you're up with your film.
Ghost Dog Millionaire?
Ghost Dog Millionaire.
All right, so...
We recently talked about this film in our 1999 movies episode.
It came out in 1999.
It did very well in the bracket.
One of the best years in cinema. Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai, directed by Jim Jarmusch. And it's a little bit out of his wheelhouse. This is not a typical... Because I think of him as...
kind of like a precursor to the mumblecore genre. And this is not that at all. It stars our boy, Forrest Whitaker.
Yes.
Who had done some things prior to this. He did Fast Times at Ridgemont High, notably The Crying Game. And then this was one of his first leading roles. He's a very solitary figure. He is a hired assassin. Oh, I shouldn't say hired because he considers himself a retainer.
Yes.
Somebody who is in the debt of somebody else and will do what they are asked to do. Although he also gets paid for every hit that he does as an assassin.
Solid.
And so he's working for this kind of mid-tier mob guy named Louis, who years previously saved his life when he was getting jumped in an alley. His real name on his birth certificate is Ghost Dog. And Ghost Dog goes by the Way of the Samurai. Specifically, he is obsessed with this book, The Hagakure. The Hagakure, which is a book of sayings by an ancient author, Yamamoto Tsunetomo. Our dog, Ghost Dog, is called for a hit, and it's another mob guy who is about the same rank
mid-level
as Louis.
Yeah.
But one thing makes him a target. He's sleeping with the boss's daughter.
Yep.
And we should point out the boss's daughter was involved in the Danny Masterson trial.
She was one of the plaintiffs in the Danny Masterson.
And she was like harassed by the Church of Scientology.
I don't know exactly what her role in the lawsuit was, because there were only two women that were accusing him of rape, but yet there were five plaintiffs.
Right.
And she was one of the plaintiffs.
She's not a Scientologist, but they came at her.
I guess so.
Don't come at me, Scientology. He gets there, he does the hit, he kills the guy he's supposed to kill, then realizes that the boss's daughter is also in the room.
He takes her copy of Rashomon.
Yes. This obviously causes problems because there weren't supposed to be any witnesses. And so the boss and his henchmen go at Louis and they're like, "What the fuck happened?" And so he has to reveal who his hired hitman is. And this is one of the best scenes in the movie, where Louis is explaining to them who his hitman is, Ghost Dog, how he communicates with him by homing pigeon, and the way that all of this works out. And so they tell him, well, you've got to take him out because now he's a witness. Or we're going to take you out, Louis. And so now Louis is after Ghost Dog. Meanwhile, Ghost Dog befriends a young girl in the park. Her name is Pearline.
Pearline.
She's a great character. She's wise beyond her years.
She was an actress on the Bernie Mac show.
No shit.
Shit.
And so she's kind of, she approaches him, but she's also guarded. And then he proves himself to be a good soul. And she's like, "Why you ain't got any friends?" And he's like, "Well, as a matter of fact, this is my best friend." And he is a Haitian.
Frenchman.
He speaks French, yeah, but yes, I think he's Haitian. From either Haiti or Dominican Republic. Right. And
he runs a food truck.
He runs a rundown ice cream truck.
Ice cream truck, that's
yeah,
right.
And the music is always like, warbled. It's like, wah, 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 wah. And even though they do not speak each other's language, they are best friends, and they have one-sided conversations. Like, "Well, I guess you've got some business you've got to take care of."
"I've got some business I got to take care of."
So even though they're speaking completely different languages that they don't understand, there is a innate communication between the two of them. Eventually, Ghost Dog, spoilers, shows up to the boss Varga's house and easily kills almost everybody there, sparing Louis, who he considers his
master.
His master.
Now, his method of killing is what?
He uses a gun
right.
versus a sword. However, when he reholsters his gun, he does the, the little samurai sword spin, and it's so fucking cool.
That's what, yes.
Eventually, Louis catches up with Ghost Dog, but not before Ghost Dog gives all of his money and takes the bullets out of his gun and gives them to our French best friend, French-speaking best friend. And then, refusing to kill his own master, he allows Louis to shoot him multiple times.
Three times, I think.
And walks closer, closer, closer to him and gives him the copy of Rashomon.
Yep.
He turns around. Ghost Dog dies peacefully with his best friend and Pearline next to him. He goes and gets in the car where the daughter is now the boss.
Yes.
And she says, "That's my book." And that's that fucking movie. Also, the soundtrack or the score was by the RZA.
RZA!
Who also makes a cameo. And it was just like...
The camouflage samurai.
Perfect.
Yep. Did you... So apparently this film was partly influenced... there's a French film called Les Samurai.
Yes, Les Samurai.
Yeah, by Jean-Pierre Melville.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of the critics pointed out the similarities.
Correct, yeah. Because it's the main character, played by the famous French actor Alain Delon, or Alain Delon, however you pronounce his name. But if you are a cinema freak, you know who he is. But anyway, very much like the Forest Whitaker character, he's a loner who has a very zen, a loner hitman who has a very zen sort of presence about him.
And it's another one of those situations where the main character is not of the traditional ethnicity of a samurai.
Right.
So this guy was French. This guy was a African-American. Not unlike a little film called The Last Samurai with Tom Cruise.
Oh, God.
Or 47 Ronin with Keanu Reeves. Oof. Or the miniseries Shogun, where they made the white dude the main character. However, I understand that that movie was, or that show was very dedicated to the actual book, the original book, which in turn was based on historical events.
Yeah. There you go.
I just wanted to rant about cultural appropriation.
Oh, sure,
for
of course.
And at the same time, I love the movie Dances with Wolves and Last of the Mohicans, Legends of the Fall.
All right, I'm going to talk about one more movie, and this one is about Cubs broadcaster Harry Carey. Hi, everybody. I'm a samurai. All right, so yeah, we're talking about 1962's Harakiri. This is directed by Masaki Kobayashi, starring Tetsuya Nakate. And this movie, as I put it in my review, this is the long play bitch slap.
Ooh.
This movie is so gratifying. You have to go along for the ride, and then when it pays off, boy, does it ever pay off.
Like somebody wrongs you, and then you wait 7 years and then embarrass them in public? Yeah.
So it's the slow burn, like, I'm not going to get you today. It might not be tomorrow. It might not be 5 years from now.
Well, it's not even that.
Day.
You don't know that you're going to be got. So here's the premise. You've seen this, Todd, haven't you?
No, I was hoping to have time to watch it.
Oh,
this
my
week,
God.
No,
okay,
I
so here's...
I haven't seen it either.
I don't want to spoil it, but I'm going to have to. Yes. This is set in between 1619 and 1630 during the Edo period.
Talking about the 17th century, guys.
Thank you very much. So this was a time when samurais were getting turned out. Their masters were dying off, and they didn't have anywhere to go. And with instead of being Ronin, where they were just out there swords for hire, they would they wanted to perform harakiri or seppuku, where they killed themselves.
Is there a difference between harakiri and seppuku?
So there was also this.
Well, I think seppuku is where someone else does it.
No.
I think so when you do it yourself. So there was a rash of con artists at the time going around to these various houses and saying, I'm a samurai without a master. I want to commit harakiri at your place and let your person, when I do it, after I disembowel myself, have your guy behead me and put an end to it, and you guys clean up the mess. And instead of having this spectacle and instead of having this mess, a lot of times these people would say, well, why don't I just give you some cash?
Right.
Just go away. Here, take some money. And so it became a scam.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the crux of this movie. This guy shows up, and I'm going to forgo a lot of the details since you guys haven't seen it.
He's a Sabuku grifter?
No, Sabuku grifter. There you go. That's the name of the film. So this guy shows up and he gives his sob story, and the master's like, you know, there's been this whole thing about these guys going around trying to grift money out of people. Mm-hmm. Tell you what, we're going to let you do your harakiri here. And my guy is going to be here to play second. He's going to chop your head off after you're done. So go ahead. Go for it.
Calls his bluff.
And the guy's like, okay, can I have 3 days? And the guy's like, no, you can't have 3 days. Go ahead and do it now.
Do it now.
He's like, but I want 3 days. No, go ahead and do it now. So the guy takes out his swords, and they're fucking bamboo swords. They're not even Bokens. Real. And they're like, man, you're a piece of shit, man. You've sold off everything that you have, even your swords.
There's
you,
no honor
you
in
have
this.
No honor. And the guy, he basically stiffens his lip and he says, okay, fine. And he commits seppuku with a fucking bamboo sword.
Damn.
Right there in the middle, it's everybody's list. The guy's like attendants are all just wincing at this. It's gross.
You're going to want to use some Lysol wipes on that bamboo sword.
True. All right. So another guy comes and they're like, hey, man, there's a guy who just came here a few weeks ago and did the same thing. Did the whole seppuku harakiri thing. And
the spiel, though, the actual commitment of the act. Right.
So this guy killed himself and they're explaining to him, you know, we're going to make you do it. And he's like, that's fine. I'm ready. I want to do it. After they tell him this whole story, he insists, I've never heard of this guy, and I'm going to go ahead and do it, but I need to know which of your attendants are going to cut my head off.
Uh-huh.
Who's your first in command? Well, he's sick. Well, who's your second in command? Well, he's sick too. Who's your third in command? Well, he's sick too. No, I need one of them to be here to cut my head off. Go find them. Go fetch them. So they send word out, and they're like, the messengers come back, and they're like, no, he can't do it. He can't do it. He can't do it.
Everybody's sick.
What you find out in the film is that the first guy that did it, his family, his wife was deathly ill, and their child was deathly ill. And the father, who was a samurai, he's like, you got to go get some money to go get some medicine. And that's what he was trying to do. He was trying to do the grift, to get the medicine, to get the money. And that's why he wanted to go back to tell him, I'm not going to succeed. Turns out the second samurai that shows up is his father-in-law. And he's showing up because his daughter's dead, his grandchild is dead, and his son-in-law is now dead. He shows up at this guy's house, and he's asking for the people that are going to attend him. And they're like, he's not here, he's not here, he's not here. One by one, he's throwing out the top knots that he's taken from each of the guys.
Oh, they're not Boom. Sick. They're dead.
Dead. Motherfuckers are dead.
Damn.
And when they realize it, all hell breaks loose. And it's a fucking bloodbath. And the guy's just like wrecking shop. And he knows he's going to die, but he's fucking taking everybody he can down with him before he goes. And I was just like, oh my God, this movie is the coolest I've ever seen.
That's wild.
It's the biggest bitch slap I've ever seen. It's so cool. So cool. So yeah, harakiri, I just ruined it for you. Sorry.
I intentionally sort of spaced out for a second so that I would get the gist, but not have it ruin the specific.
Intentionally.
That's yeah. Okay. I'm good at I got, not paying I got, attention I got to the, you either.
That was not... So I got the gist of what you were saying, but I didn't want to have it ruined because I will That's be watching
fine.
That soon.
It's fine. It's really good.
I zoned out because I was lost in your eyes.
Thanks, baby. All right. So those are samurai movies. We might have time to talk about other films that we've watched or want to talk
yes.
about.
Movie marathon check-ins.
So sure. Let's do some movie marathon check-ins.
Sean, you go first.
Well, I've been in samurai mode. I watched Ran, which mm-hmm. is the Akira Kurosawa 1985 epic samurai movie.
Yeah, I haven't seen that.
Holy fuck balls. It's a big production and it's worth watching. It's really cool.
That's not the one that Spielberg, there was one that Spielberg, funded at one point.
No, this was by the French.
That's Dreams. I'm going to talk about Dreams. Yes.
This is with the French Film Commission.
Kajmusha. I guess he must have done two. He also did Kajmusha.
Okay.
I did watch Throne of Blood, which I'm sorry.
That's a good one.
I'm sorry, Todd. That was a remake of Macbeth, not Hamlet.
Yes.
You're not supposed to say that first one.
I know. In the theater, you're not. I watched Yojimbo. Yojimbo was cool. Fistful of Dollars.
I think it's Yojimbo.
It's Yojimbo.
Is it really?
Yeah.
So the J's are H's in Japanese as well?
It is in this one.
So I just have to mention this, and I might have mentioned it before. There is a weird crossover between pronunciation in Spanish and Portuguese and Japanese. For example, the word arigato and obrigado.
Mm.
And I know for a fact that the Portuguese were exploring and attempting to colonize Japan back in the day.
Okay.
And I feel like there's just this linguistic overlap that I find very fascinating.
Well, there are a lot of Japanese words that are derivative of the Spanish language,
mm-hmm.
which is really weird if you're just like hearing it and you hear like this very harsh, comparatively to their language. It's really strange how some of those words still erupt from time to time.
Mm-hmm. My first check-in today is going to be number 68. This movie is called Dreams, or Akira Kurosawa's Dreams. It's from 1990, but it looks earlier for some reason. I don't know if he was affecting like a grainy quality. But Sean and I can relate to this movie a lot because we are very vivid dreamers.
The Dreams episode.
Yeah. This is a series of fever dreams that Akira Kurosawa actually had recurringly. It's told in 8 vignettes, so it's a anthology. And it was co-produced by George Lucas and Steven Spielberg, who in this review I spelled his name as Sven Spielberg. And for some reason, Martin Scorsese is Vincent Van Gogh in one of the segments. It was really cool, but like I totally understand like where he's coming from because dreams are fucked up. Indeed. Dreams are weird, man.
As Stevie Nicks told us.
Do you have another one?
I'm actually not gonna do a movie. I'm gonna do a Netflix series I recently watched called Unlocked, which is an experiment that was done in an Alabama prison where the sheriff came in one of the more violent blocks of the prison. And instead of having them on lockdown for 23, so they were, the way that this block worked was they were on lockdown for 23 hours and had free time for 1 hour.
Now in this free time, could they do whatever they wanted?
No, they were, no, that was the thing. They had someone watching them at all times. So this sheriff had, you know, looked into like prison systems in Europe and things like that. I was like, listen, we need to give them more freedom. Actually, it's actually the opposite of what we're doing. We should give them more freedom, more autonomy. And the evidence suggests that this will work. So he convinced the people in this prison system to go along with this. And some of the people in this, I mean, and this was not like, you know, petty criminals. Some of these people were up for capital murder and things like this. So, so what happens is, they take away the guards that usually there's always a guard there. There's no guard there. They don't make them stay in for the 20, you know, they get 1 hour out and 23 hours in the cell. No more of that. They can kind of hang out.
Wait. How much time do they get inside and then outside?
Before they're in the cell 23 hours a day, 1 hour out. When they do this experiment, they just have the freedom to, I mean, they don't even say.
Oh, shit. It's like a battle royale.
Yeah. Well, that's what some people are worried about. His theory is, this sheriff's theory is, okay, based on the evidence of places that do this, it'll actually work out. They'll, you know, they'll work together. They'll come up with a system that works.
It's an evidence-based strategy.
Yeah. And so it's a really cool because you get to know a lot of these inmates, some of them who are like hardened criminals. But
wait, is this a documentary?
hard.
It depends what time of day.
Erect, but whatever. But in any case, it's interesting though because there is like an order that starts to emerge as you start to watch this.
Is it fictional or is it a documentary?
No, it's real.
It's a documentary.
Yeah, it's a documentary. And you know, and peep and
when do they start playing the
people
Squid
that,
Games?
The people that don't get on board, it's interesting to see how they like
it's
deal
Squid Game.
You know, see how they deal with these people who don't want to get on board with the program. And there's this whole thing about like the older guys, of course, are trying to mentor the younger people.
Yeah, they're veterans.
But the younger people are like, fuck y'all, you're felons too. Like,
just
so
like a rookie would say.
Anyway, it's really cool. I recommend watching.
Very good.
Unlocked.
Can awesome. Can I do another one and then we'll both talk about one that we both watched?
Oh gosh, yeah, sure.
All right, so this one's going to be very brief. I watched Monkey Man.
Okay.
Now this is Dev Patel's directorial debut. Is it directorial or directorial?
We talked about this
directorial.
Last week.
Directorial.
Yeah.
Okay.
Directorial.
He decided that he wanted to make a better John Wick movie and also write it and star in it. And it's fucking awesome. It's also mirrors the plot of a lot of these vengeance samurai movies because his town in India, his village in India is wiped out by a local corrupt police force and his mother is raped and killed. And so he, instead of becoming trained as a samurai assassin, he becomes an underground MMA fighter who wears a monkey mask, and he almost always loses because he's got a deal with the promoter, Charlto Copley, where he gets a cut of the winnings, or people are gambling, right? But then he works his way into the upper echelon of society in this area, where the sheriff and the corrupt police force are also working in tandem with this basically celebrity cult guru.
Jesus.
Yeah. And so he has to, you know, go in, kick ass, wipe him out. Now, I will say one thing that differs from the John Wick movies is that he's not particularly trained in,
yeah, I got that from the trailer.
Like gunplay, yeah. Or he basically can take a beating.
Okay.
That's his advantage. And that he's very patient.
Okay.
Which is another one of those revenge is a dish best served cold,
I
right?
Like it. Yep.
So, yeah. And then we both watched a movie that was highly anticipated.
Yes.
A kind of almost an art house horror.
Yes.
At least it was presented as that. And it's called Late Night with the Devil.
Yes.
Now, obviously, you're thinking, that's the name of my favorite porno. But it's not that. It's about a guy named Jack
Delroy.
Jack Delroy, who is battling against Johnny Carson for the top spot in the late night wars of the mid to late 70s. And you might say he's got to make some sacrifices.
Yeah. I was on board for this movie and I was hyped for this movie. And the first time I watched it, I was let down because I had built it up too big in my brain. So I watched,
I think you took three melatonins before you watched this movie.
So I watched it a second time. And while I still don't rate it as highly as you do, I do like this movie.
Yeah.
I'm excited for what might come from this franchise if they want to make it a franchise.
I don't know how you could. I don't know how you could make it a franchise, but I will say I was intrigued by the idea of it supposedly being a lost master tape. But you have a theory about
yes.
this.
Well, I have an improvement on the film.
Okay.
And because if it is a master tape, there would not be a two-camera black and white behind the scenes during the breaks. What I think would improve the film if they would just let the cameras unmanned just sit there. So you're picking up wild audio and whatever context clues you can from people passing in front of the camera or what's in the fringe really opens the door for some creepy shit to happen.
I think that's brilliant.
And that would have made the movie better for me. If you haven't already, please follow us on social media. And we're Cinema Chop Shop everywhere except for YouTube, where we're Cinema Chop Shop Podcast, where you can listen to a video presentation of this podcast. But
you psychos.
You psycho beasts, you. We're going to do an episode in a couple of weeks. I think it's going to be another watch party. It's a film that I think that everyone needs to watch, and I'm going to keep it a secret for now.
Oh.
It's something I've talked
about.
We
also had an idea that we've talked about but never done a proper episode on.
Oh, yeah.
Twin films.
Not twin brother and sister, brothers. Movies that come out at the same time
that are basically the same movie. A la your Tombstone and Wyatt Earp.
So we'll get into that a little bit later. In the meantime, we want you to love your friends and love yourself. And
Tell them you love them
and just take advantage of the time you have together. And please remember to
watch, chop, retrofit.